Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
March the 16th, and we are in Sefer Daniel, Parak Ches, Chapter 8. Last time we read the entire Parak, and we saw what his vision was. And we said that this time we would go into it a little bit more in depth. So to review quickly what the vision was, it says in the beginning of the parak, it was the third year of Belshazzar's rule, the third and last year of his rule, which means it's the last year of the kingdom of Babel, of Babylonia. And he sees first a ram, and this ram has two horns, one shorter than the other. The shorter one comes up first, then the longer one. And this ram is able to gore and is able to conquer all different directions, west, north, and south. And no animals could stand up to this ram. We see later on in the vision that this ram represents Paras and Madai, the Persians and the Medes, who will, as an alliance, defeat Babel and become the ruling power of the known world. The reason why the first horn is shorter than the second horn is because the first horn represents Madai, because the first king of this alliance was Daryavish the Mede from Madai, and he is succeeded only a year by Koresh, his son-in-law, who was Persian, and then from then on all the kings were Persian. So the Madai kings only lasted 1 year, and then came only Persian kings. Then that ram is challenged by a goat that Daniel sees coming from the west, and it's covering the entire land, and it's got this very visible horn between its eyes. And it comes to the goat comes to the ram and destroys the ram, decimates the ram, tramples it, and essentially takes over. This represents the Greek nation deposing the Persians and the Medes and becoming the ruling power of the world. This goat becomes very powerful, and the one horn then turns into four horns, which later on it will be explained to him by Gabriel, by the angel Gabriel, that the one horn is the first king of the Greeks, which of course is Alexander the Great, and then he is succeeded by four different kingdoms, four different generals of his who take over after his death. They are not as powerful as he is. Then one of those horns another horn comes out of one of the horns, and it becomes greater than all the rest, and it not only conquers the world, but it also goes up to the heavens and wreaks havoc in the heavens. And that one horn represents the Romans, who are an outgrowth of the Greeks, and they conquer everything, and they're more powerful than anything else. And there's an allusion here even to stopping the tamid, stopping the carbon tamid, the daily sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. Then Daniel said, he heard one of the holy ones speaking, which is an angel, saying, how long will this go on for? How long will the Beis HaMikdash be destroyed for? And the answer was, in Pasuk Yudal, verse 14, until Erev Boker, ad Erev Boker, until evening morning, Alpayim Ushlosh Meos, 2,300. Then Daniel says, I wanted to understand this vision better, and so a voice came out saying to Gabriel, go explain this to Daniel. Gavriel comes to Daniel. Daniel, he is overwhelmed by the angel and falls on his face. And then Gavriel touches him and he's able to stand. And then he explains to him everything we just said in the explanation of what the dream means. And then at the very end of the perek, in Pasuk Chavav in verse 26, he says, the vision of the evening and the morning, Ashenemar, that was said, Emesu, it is true. V'atas esomech hazon, and you should close the vision. In other words, it's going to stay obscure. Ki liyamim rabbi, because it's going to be after many days. And then the parak ends, V'ani Daniel, v'hiyesi v'necheleisi, I was sick and perturbed for many days. I got up and I did the work of the king. And I was confused. I was out of sorts because of the vision. But no one knew. I kept it hidden. Daniel did not let people know how much he was bothered by this vision. So there are a few points that we could go into over here. As I said, since the shiur is only going to last as long as my voice lasts, I want to pick the most important parts. And let's go straight into the years. And this is one of the main places where people love to predict when Mashiach is going to come. Because Daniel says in Pasuk Yud Daled, in verse 14, that the angel said, until Erev Boker, until evening and morning, Alpayim Ushlosh Meos, 2,300. Now, it doesn't say 2,300 what. It's a unit of some sort. 2,300 what. So the assumption is 2,300 years. And Erev Boker means evening and morning. Now, there are different ways of interpreting Ad Erev Boker, until evening and morning. Some want to say Erev Boker means that time when Mashiach comes, which will be considered the evening turning into morning, the evening meaning the darkness of the galus of the exile turning into a bright light of redemption. So some want to say that the words Erev Boker, evening morning, has nothing to do with the cheshbon, has nothing to do with the calculation. It's just saying that that's what's going to happen, that when will Erev Boker happen? When will we have this bright light which will replace the darkness of the night? That will be after 2,300 something. 2,300 years, ostensibly. Rashi rejects this because at the end of the Perek, it says, as we just read in Pasuk Chava, verse 26, the angel says, Umarei ha'erev v'haboker asher nemar, and the vision of evening and morning that was said, emesu, it is true. Rashi understands that he is referring to the calculation. The calculation is true. Don't think that the calculation is untrue, even though it's not going to be for many days. And so Rashi understands the words erev boker are there to tip us off to an aspect of the calculation. It's not just 2,300, but there's also Erev Boker involved as well. So I'm going to take you through Rashi's calculation. I'm going to warn you up front that Rashi's calculation is wrong, that the time that Rashi predicted has already passed. And then I will remind you what we spoke about last week about mistaken calculations for when Mashiach is going to come. Rashi speaks about that as well. Now, one other point we have to see before we go through Rashi's calculation is that if you look at the very end of Sefer Daniel, almost the last pasuk, it's not the last pasuk, the last couple of pasukim in Sefer Daniel, there is another reference to how long it will be until Mashiach comes. And in Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12, pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, it says, Umeis husara tamid, and from the time that the tamid, the daily offering, was removed, v'lases shikutz shomeim, and to give desolation and terrible desolation, meaning the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, yomim elef masayim v'sishim, it'll be 1,290. Again, 1,290 what? It says yomim days, but yomim can also mean years. It's generally understood to mean 1,290 years. And then it says in the next pasuk, Ashrei HaMechakeh, fortune is the one who awaits, V'yagi al yamim, and will get to those days. And then it says another calculation, Elef Shlosh Meos Shlosh HaMechamisha, 1,335. So, ignoring that second one, dealing first with this 1,290, Rashi attempts to calibrate the 1,290 mentioned at the end of Sefer Daniel with the 2,300 and Erev Boker and evening morning mentioned here in our chapter. So I'm going to put it on the board and work us through his calculation, even though, as I said, it's wrong. It has already passed, but it's still informative of how what Rashi does. Let's go through it step by step. So, let me first put the numbers on the board. The one in our parak says 2,300, and it says Erev Boker. I'm going to write that in Hebrew because we're going to have to know the Hebrew letters. Erev Boker means evening morning, but I'm going to write it in Hebrew. We have Erev Boker. I'll put the transliteration above that. Erev Boker. Okay? That's what we have in our chapter. That's Parak Ches, chapter 8. At the end, there's two other numbers given. There is 1,290, and then there's 1,335. Okay, now, what Rashi says is, he insists that the words Erev Boker are part of the calculation. It's not just the time of the great light, but it actually is part of the calculation. He says, you have to add the gematria, the numerical value of Erev Boker, to 2300. Now, if you, the gematria, what is the gematria of Erev Boker? So I'm going to write it, let's write it a little differently now. Let's write it, Ayin, Resh, Beis, Beis, Kuf, Resh. You have six letters, and we're going to add up their numerical value. What's an Ayin? How much? Anybody know?
70.
Resh, 200. Beis, two. Another Beis is another two. Kuf,
100.
Another Resh is 200. So that equals 574. So, according to Rashi, you add 574 to 2,300. So you get 2,874. So Rashi says that when it says the Tamid will be batal, that the Tamid will no longer be brought, that it's 2,874 years. But Rashi understands it's not 2,874 years from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's 2,874 years from the time that we went down to Egypt. That's how Rashi understands it. He counts all the way back from the time we went down to Egypt, 2,874 years. Rashi understands that the 1290 at the end of Sefer Daniel is counting from when the Tamid ended. And if you count 2874 from when we left Egypt, and you count 1290 from when the Tamid stopped, they will come out to be the same year. That's what Rashi says. Now let's go through it. I'm going to erase this part now, and let's go through the calculation for when we left Egypt, when we went down to Egypt, until the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So first of all, we went down to Egypt. How many years were we in Egypt? 210 years. So we were in Egypt for 210 years. Okay. Fine. Then we left Egypt. When we left Egypt, we were in the Midbar, in the wilderness, for how long?
40 years.
40 years. Okay. That is the wilderness. Okay, how many years from the time we entered Israel until the Beis HaMikdash was built? The It's not somewhere along the road, it is a, it is an explicit pasuk. How much?
449.
Very close. 440. Very close. It is a pasuk in the in Sefer Malachim. In Sefer Malachim, when the Beis Hamikdash is built, it says that it was 440 years that it was built. So 440 years until first temple. Okay, how long did the first temple last? 410 years. Okay, and how long was the exile after that in Babel? 70. Okay, I'll just write exile here. Okay, and how long does the second temple last? 420 years. And then we get confusion, because then we're into common era. Common era is very confusing. Let's add up what we have till here. So we have till here 5, 9, 10, 90, and 3, 7, 11, 15. We get 1590. So from the time we left Egypt till the second temple is destroyed, it's 1,590 years. That's not disputable. Meaning, that is explicit in either the Psukim or the Gemara. That is 1,590 years from the time we leave Egypt, from the time we get to Egypt, not leave Egypt, from the time we get to Egypt till we leave. That doesn't tell you what year it is. Just that's the length of time. So now, the number was 2,874. So if we subtract 1,590 from 2,874, we'll get how many years after the destruction of the first of the second Beis HaMikdash Mashiach was supposed to come, according to Rashi. So if we go 2874 minus 1590, so how much is that? 1,284. That's very close to 1,290. Right?
The number here, you know, it's a
little different. Yeah. It's very close, but not quite. So Rashi says that it's true that that's when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. From the time we went down to Egypt until we left, until the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, was 1,590. But Rashi says, but the Tamid, the sacrifice, was stopped 6 years before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So we're going to back up 6 years. And then we get 1,584. Because 6 years is when Tamid stopped. So now, instead of subtracting 1590, we're only going to subtract 1584. And you'll get exactly 1,290. So Rashi says that the number in Parakhes, in chapter 8, the chapter we're in, which is counting 2300 plus Erev Boker, which is 574, which is counting 2874, that's counting from the time we went down to Egypt. The number at the end of Sefer Daniel, which says 1290, is counting from when the Tamid stopped. And if we put the comma in the wrong place here, we'll add the 1290 over here, and we get 2874. So 2890, this is after destruction. Okay, now what year was the second base something that's destroyed in? I'm talking about a secular year. What year was that?
70.
Okay, they say 70. It's probably more like 68. So it's probably not an exact thing over there. It's 70 because it gets mixed up with the year 0 and 1 and all that. It's a little bit confusing. But let's use, for argument's sake, we'll say 68 as an argument. Well, we'll say 70. We can even say, let's say 70. It's the latest. It's only going to be later than 70. So, according to Rashi, 70 is when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. We'll go back 6 years, because that's when the Tamid was stopped. So the year is 64. So that means we're going to count 1290 from the year 64. And that comes out to the year 1354. According to Rashi, Mashiach should have come in the year 1354. No later than the year 1354. It didn't happen. Now, this is not an exact number, because as much as we say that it happened, that the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash happened around the year 68 and all that, remember that the secular dates are off. It is certainly not 2011 years since the event that they are counting, that they're saying it's 2011 years from. That's for sure not true. Because remember that the event that the secular world counts from, which is based on the Christian religion, that event was an absolutely insignificant event when it happened. That event meant nothing to most people in the world, except for very few, very marginalized few people back when it actually happened. It was not for many, many years that before the Christian religion became a popular religion, and then they had to go back and figure out its origins. And so there is no question that there is ambiguity and there is confusion over how many years have passed since that event. The Ramban, Nachmanides, in his Vikuach, in his famous debate with the Christian authorities, he was hauled in for a debate, and they had a Jew who had converted to Christianity, who was their man trying to undermine the Ramban, trying to show that the Ramban was Jewish religion was mistaken, that there were problems with it, and they had a back and forth, and it's recorded. We have the Ramban's the recording of that debate. In it, one of the points that he makes to them is that your whole cheshbon, your whole calculation is off, because no one paid any attention to the events that they are claiming happened 2011 years ago. So this is not going to be an exact number. When we say 68 or 70 or whatever the Beis HaMikdash actually was destroyed, it may have been later than that. It's hard to know exactly because the years are confused. But no matter what we say, even if we're going to tack on another 100 years, it's still time has passed. Rashi's calculation is wrong. It did not come true. What Rashi wrote did not happen. It did not. This whole calculation that he makes, which is fascinating, and it does come out perfectly according to Rashi, but it does not work. Now, just as an aside, just to complete what Rashi actually says, what about this number? This 1335, which is 45 years more than the other number. Rashi says that he found in a source. Which source was it? He found in a source. Well, okay, I don't want to. The source he found doesn't say this exactly the way Rashi says it. So let's leave out the source. But Rashi suggests that there is going to be a 45-year gap from that Mashiach is going to come, and then he will somehow disappear for 45 years and then reemerge. Rashi says that. So what does that mean? Why would it happen? How does it happen? I have no idea. But Rashi attempts to reconcile these two numbers, that one of them is when Mashiach first appears, and the other one is 45 years later when something else happens. Whatever that means. Okay.
Who knows?
Eliyahu is not Mashiach. The Gemara says that even though Eliyahu HaNavi is supposed to precede Mashiach, right? The Gemara says Eliyahu HaNavi is supposed to precede Mashiach. He's supposed to come and be Mevaser the Geula. He's supposed to announce the Geula. That's why on Pesach Nei we open the door. We're not opening the door for Eliyahu. Eliyahu can get in without the door. We open the door to show that we are unafraid
because it's a Leil Shimur, it's a night of protection. So we open the door to show that we have emuna, that we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to protect us. And in the zechus, in the merit of trusting in Hashem, we want Eliyahu to come and be mevaser the Gula and announce that Mashiach is going to come. Eliyahu precedes the coming of Mashiach. So the Gemara says that, but there's a distinct difference between Eliyahu and Mashiach. The Gemara says that how does it go? That Eliyahu cannot come on a Friday. Right? Eliyahu cannot come on a Friday or on Erev Yontif, day before Yontif. Can't come. Why? Because if Eliyahu comes, you imagine Eliyahu shows up in human form. He shows up. Now, we're talking about a Navi, talking about a prophet. So, Eliyahu shows up. Now, we haven't seen a Talmud Chacham the likes of Eliyahu HaNavi in thousands of years. There's been nobody remotely close to the greatness of Eliyahu HaNavi on this earth for thousands of years. So, just think about it. Let's say, let's leave out Eliyahu HaNavi. Let's say the Chafetz Chaim would show up. Every single one of us would drop whatever we're doing and go and greet the Chafetz Chaim, because he's one of the greatest people, certainly greater than anybody else alive today. So we would drop whatever we're doing, we would go run. It's a mitzvah, we go run to be mekabel panav, to go greet the Chafetz Chaim. If Eliyahu HaNavi would come, then certainly we would, not only would we want to, we would have to drop everything and go see him, go greet him. So the Gemara says, so if he would come on a Friday, then who's going to make Shabbos? Everybody's going to have to drop what they're doing and go greet Eliyahu HaNavi. So what's going to happen with Shabbos? We're not going to prepare for Shabbos. Therefore, Hashem would not send Eliyahu on a Friday. So the Gemara says, then what about Mashiach? Mashiach is greater than Eliyahu HaNavi. Mashiach is supposed to be, according to the Rambam, he's supposed to be the second greatest Navi to ever live, except for Moshe Rabbeinu. Second to Moshe. Greater than Eliyahu HaNavi. So if we're going to drop everything to go greet Eliyahu HaNavi, we're certainly going to drop everything to go greet Mashiach. So, how could Mashiach come on a Friday? Someone says, no, that's no problem. Because once Mashiach comes, then there's no more Shibud Malchios. Once Mashiach comes, we're no longer subservient to the nations of the world. Everybody then recognizes that Hashem is the true God. And then, they will take care of our needs. They'll make sure Shabbos is taken care of. So we don't need to worry about that. But I'm pointing out to you that Eliyahu HaNavi, we don't have that guarantee. With Eliyahu HaNavi, we're going to go run to greet him, and no one's going to take care of Shabbos for us. But with Mashiach, well. So that's what the Gemara says in Mesachas Erevin. That's what he says. Now, this is all the calculation of Rashi. But it didn't come true. That's what he says. So, how do we deal with the fact that it didn't come true? So I mentioned to you last week that Rashi himself says this. Rashi, first, before he makes this whole calculation, mentions that he saw a calculation of Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon preceded Rashi by I want to say 200 years. I don't remember exactly how many years it was, but he preceded Rashi, and he made his own calculation. He also learned Sefer Daniel, and he made his own calculation. And Rashi says that Rav Sadia Gaon, it was a nice calculation, but it passed already. So it was wrong. Rashi says about Rav Sadia Gaon's calculation. Even in Rashi's
time,
that's much later. That's much later.
Does that have to do with
eggs? Hold on.
Yeah, okay.
So Rav Sadia Gaon says. So Rashi says Rav Sadia Gaon's calculation was wrong because it already passed. It didn't happen. So obviously it was wrong. So Rashi writes that. So then, what's the point of all these calculations? So Rashi says the darshan, the one who wants to expound upon the psukim, will do so and come up with a new calculation, and we will wait for that time, and if it doesn't come true, we will recalculate and wait for the next time, and if it doesn't come true, we'll recalculate and wait for the next time. As Rashi says that we steadfastly believe that Mashiach is going to come. We steadfastly believe that these calculations, that these psukim, that these verses are correct. However, we don't know necessarily how to calculate them. And as a result, we accept the fact that our calculations may be wrong, but we're going to make them anyway. And we're going to wait anyway. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. We'll go on to the next one. The Rambam writes, when it comes to Mashiach, the Rambam writes, no one really knows that everything you see in the various sources about Mashiach, it's all an educated guess. All we know is what the Psukim say, but nobody really knows. Unlike other parts of Torah, where it's not an educated guess, where there is a Mesorah, there is a tradition about what the halacha is, what actually happened in a particular story, there is Medrash, etc. When it comes to the coming of Mashiach, says the Rambam, no one really knows. It is all an educated guess. Now obviously, Rashi's educated guess is going to be far better than any of our educated guesses. But it's still nothing more than an educated guess. And Rashi says, that's fine. We'll take a guess. So, why would we do that? Why would we take a guess if we're not sure it's going to be true? Why bother with this? And so we have these psukim. So Rashi was wrong. So after Rashi, others also attempted to interpret these psukim, and they were also wrong. And so far, anybody who's interpreted anything before the year 5771 has been wrong. Anybody whose final number is after the year 5771 has not yet been proven wrong. Are they right? Well, we'll find out. So what is the point of making these calculations? It's almost absurd. Like, why bother? Are we just fond of taking guesses? You know, the later you make your year, the more likely you have a chance of, well, not even, not the more likely you have a chance of being right, but at least you won't be proven wrong for more time. Right? So what's the point of all that? What is it? Why bother with it? So it seems they're taking their cue from the Navi himself. And Hashem told Daniel these words. He gave him the visions. He gave him the first one, he gave him the second one. All these numbers, the 2300 Erev Boker, whether Erev Boker is part of 2300 or not part of 2300, he gave him that number. 1290, he gave him that number. 1335, he gave him that number. Why did Hashem do that? Is Hashem just trying to tease us? Like, what's the point of all the numbers? Evidently, Hashem wants us to be teased. He wants us to come up with calculations to figure it out, because it would seem one of two things, and they might both be right. One reason could be because, as Rashi says, that way we keep waiting. We have something to wait for. We're saying, oh, it's just a little further, just a little further, just a little further. And even though it ends up being much later, but there is at least a sense of anticipation that goes on, because people are still calculating, calculating, calculating. Or perhaps the calculations aren't really wrong. Perhaps the calculations are all true. That there are many ways of interpreting these psukim, and that the different ways of interpreting them are the most likely times for Mashiach to come. And that Rav Sadia Gaon's calculation was correct, that was one of the most likely times that he would come. He didn't, because unfortunately we didn't deserve it. Rashi's calculation is correct, that around the year 1354 or thereabouts was a time that was likely for Mashiach to come. It was perhaps easier to bring Mashiach at that time than other times. But unfortunately, it didn't pan out. We didn't deserve it. And the other calculations that are made based on these psukim, assuming that the calculations are done properly, it could be that there are 10, 12, 15 possible ways of interpreting this, and they're all correct, but they all point to times that are more likely for Mashiach to come. Now, Mashiach can come any time. We're not limited to these times, but perhaps these times are the times that are the most likely. And then when they pass, all that says to us is, unfortunately, we didn't deserve it this time around. But that doesn't mean that the calculations were bad, wrong, or not considered Torah. I'm not sure if this is correct. And giving you two possibilities for why we would be teased, and why it seems from Rashi that it is appropriate to try to figure out the psukim. But whether one of these is correct, one of these ideas is correct, whether they're both correct or they're both wrong, I can't tell you.
Rabbi,
wasn't the plague? Okay, one at a time. Good.
Wasn't the Black Plague over at that time, and they thought maybe that was an irony of hope?
I don't know.
I tend to think that God, it's like we who discipline children. I will talk to you later when it, 8 o'clock tonight. So Hashem says, you know, Mashiach is coming because I've already predicted it here. It will be, but to God's calculations. It's like a sense of very strong hope, otherwise we never know if Mashiach will come.
But why calculate? That's the question. Why calculate?
Because you made the Jewish plan so absolutely want it. If we can figure out the lunar month, then we to the, what, one thousandths to the tenth, then he figured we'll spend our time doing that. But isn't this all based on faith, that God just says, yes, the Mashiach is coming?
There's no question.
Just the faith is, you must have faith as to, I know when it's best.
Yeah.
But will you please tell me about the Vilna Gaon? Wasn't it supposed to be, and then the Industrial Age came in instead or something like that?
The Vilna Gaon, I have not read inside. I've never seen it written inside what he says. I heard once that he said no later than the year 5800. Yeah,
wow.
Which, you know, that we can already think about. That's, you know, right?
That's pretty
But again, you know, he's not going to be any more right than Rashi.
That's,
yeah, there are others who came before him also said. So I don't know what that means. But again, I didn't see that written down. I just heard someone once say
that. Say that Mashiach can come, like you said, he disappeared for 45 years.
Whatever that means.
So whatever that means, couldn't he have come and we don't even understand what the 45
No. Rashi is saying that he would become visible. You'd know he's here, and then for 45 years something's going to happen. I don't know what.
He wouldn't come and go.
Whatever that means, I don't know. But again, the Rashi here is, it's, I won't say it's speculative, but it's an educated guess.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Is there any chance that Erev Boker seems very important? Because, first of all, it's mentioned with the time. So I just had this thought, and I don't know anything. I don't know anything more than anybody else. But the first time Boker is mentioned is creation, beginning of creation. So Arab Boker would be right at the beginning,
right,
of creation.
Right.
So is it possible that the calculations mean from the time of creation?
Could be, but that time
forward instead of any time that we know.
It could be, but that time for sure it's past.
Right.
It's way more than 5771, not 2300. Yeah. So, but you're right. It could be, and it could be that it's also an accurate way of reading the puzzle. I don't know, but it's a possibility.
And the other question is in 1354. Do you know if there was any? I mean, there were false messiahs all along.
Yeah, there were false messiahs all along. I didn't want to go look at the year 1354 so specifically, because since since the secular dating is so skewed,
yeah.
I didn't want to. You know, it's
so
around.
You know,
it's going to fall out around that time. But I'm not sure. You know, exactly what year.
When was Shabbatai Svi?
What's that?
When was Shabbatai Svi?
Later. That's too early for Shabbatai. Yeah.
So last week when you asked this question, I thought about it. To me, it's a little kid. And if a little kid really loves someone, like, you know, they say, Grandma's going to come, and the kid is excited. And they say, Grandma just has to, you know, do these 8 things, and then she'll be there. And the kid's mind, he can look and say, wow, okay, I can imagine Grandma doing this, and then doing, okay, Grandma should be here. You know, like, she's done with the list. Because they're so eager. And by doing these calculations, that's what we're showing Mashiach, that we love Mashiach so much and we want him to come so much that we're envisioning all the things we have to do and take care of. And, okay, we're going to get it ready because we want Mashiach to come now. To me, it's an excitement. It's a love that we're showing. And that's why the reason for the calculation, because mentally we're figuring, we want them here so soon.
It could be.
But to me, it's a different, it's like excitement that's being generated in love.
It could be, you're right. It could be that's the reason. And the question we're trying to answer is that normally when the Torah demands of us a calculation, it's because that's considered the study of Torah. When you calculate something, even if it does not have a practical application, but it is within the realm of Torah, then that is Torah. But if you calculate something wrong, then that's not Torah, because it was the wrong calculation. Mm-hmm. And so they say, that the only teacher, the only Rebbe that a person has that teaches them 100% truth is their Aleph Beis teacher, because that's 100% Aleph, Beis, Gimel. That's true. That's true. And once you get into anything else, there could be elements of it that aren't 100% right, and then it's not exactly right. So the question that we're bothered with is why would it seems like Rashi is condoning it, is going through these calculations, even though you know that it's likely you're not going to come out to be true. So you're saying maybe the reason could be because that's Hashem wants to have that generated excitement. Now, You all know that I have mentioned before that it is a waste of time to speculate about what's going to happen when Mashiach comes. To talk about we learned in Yechezkel about Melchemes Gog Magog. There's some kind of war, and talking about the bones and about Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. A lot of Mashiach talk is pointless. It does not give any value to us. It does not make us better Jews. It's much more valuable to talk about Torah, to talk about Chesed, to talk about encouraging ourselves, giving ourselves chizuk to do the right thing, and to be better Jews. That's much more valuable than it is to speculate about what will happen in time of Mashiach. This is not in contrast to that, meaning that it seems that Rashi is condoning calculating when he will come. He is not condoning spending hours trying to guess what will happen, or to try to guess, okay, where does Iran fit in, where do the Russians fit in, and where do this fit in, where do the Arabs fit in, and all that. That is a waste of time. It is a total waste of time. There is no point in doing that. There's no point. It does not help anything. The fact is that we have enemies in this world. We have enemies that seek to destroy us, enemies that do horrible things to us, and it is our job to prevent them from doing it, and the way that we prevent them from doing it is by keeping the Torah. That's the way. There is no magic pill. The way we keep them from doing it is by keeping the Torah. We're not going to bring Mashiach any faster by speculating about who's what. Who's Amalek today? And who represents Edom today? It's all a waste of time.
That, you can definitely tell.
But there's no value in that. But Rashi is saying that there is value in trying to figure out these calculations, because it seems that it does give hope. It does give a certain sense of longing that, okay, 5,800, I can deal with that, you know. Everybody in this room can make it to 5,800. That's, you know.
Maybe so we won't forget.
It keeps it alive. But within that, Rashi is still saying, don't get too caught up with it, because it could be wrong. And you don't want to get, if you're looking at 5,800 and then it's now 5,801, well, I guess it didn't happen. So we'll calculate again.
Rabbi,
we don't just say forget it.
There's Musar in Yehezkel, and there's Musar in Daniel. And if the calculations were to have a purpose, for me, it would be because this, we're reading this because this was written for us too.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it would be, you know, what are we learning from the Musar, and what occurred at these calculations at these times through that filter where we didn't deserve Mashiach to come? If Mashiach was to come at that time, give or take a few years, what were we doing where we didn't listen, we didn't do the right thing, and this is, you know, where we could have ended,
okay,
you know, the
okay, way that we That's possible. The Gemara does say.
So what are we learning from it? Is my, what, and we're learning. So You're elucidating on the Sefer Daniel, but what are we learning for it for a practical life where we can help change things?
The Gemara does say that that any generation that Mashiach does not come in, it's as if the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in that generation. Which means that if we live through our generation and God forbid Mashiach does not come, then that means that had we had a Beis HaMikdash, it would have been destroyed. So that means that every generation is held accountable for not rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. We could have done it. That's what the Gemara is saying. So when you go back to, let's say, the year 1354 and say, what happened then? Whatever happened then is still happening now. Mm-hmm. We're not correcting it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the focus would be what did they do wrong, but the focus might be what were the circumstances that made it more likely that Mashiach could have come. And I don't know what the answer is, because I don't know the exact year, and I don't know, you know, you have to have a good sense of what was going on at that time.
For us, so, what we learn from it, that we can apply and, you know, hopefully change, that can occur.
Well, we, you know, as I said, the only way to hasten Mashiach is keeping the Torah. there's no shortcut. You hasten Mashiach by keeping the Torah. That's it. Yeah.
I'm puzzled by why Daniel is bothered by this. He says he's bothered, but he tries not to show it, and he's keeping it in. Is it bothered because he has to keep it in and he can't tell people? Is he bothered because it's so far away? I mean, you know, what is it that's bothering him?
I think it's because he sees all the destruction that's going to happen between his time and Mashiach. He sees the ram, the goat, you know, he sees what's going to happen, all this destruction, and he knows it's going to be a lot of pain and suffering before Mashiach comes. He doesn't have hope that, you know, we're talking years down the line. Years down the line.
Now, if he feels this way, why doesn't he plead the Jewish people's cause and say to Hashem, Hashem, please?
Well, so let's wait and see as we move through Sefer Daniel. Let's see how that goes. Now, bear in mind that when the Gemara gives its top picks for who Mashiach might be,
the Academy Award.
Yeah, the Gemara gives its top choices. The Gemara says, Mashiach can come from people who are alive or from people who are dead. Mashiach doesn't have to be alive. Mashiach could be someone who is brought back to life and becomes Mashiach. As long as they are a descendant of David HaMelech, then that could be Mashiach. The thing is, though, that your pool of people who are alive, of eligible people who are alive, is a lot smaller than your pool of eligible people who are dead. Because if you're going to go back to the people who are dead, you got to deal with, you know, thousands of years of history. It could be anybody from the line of David HaMelech going all the way back. So it's once you're dealing with people who have already passed away, then it's your pool is much larger. If you're dealing with people who are alive, so how many people today are, first of all, descendants of David HaMelech, and second of all, in the ballpark of becoming Mashiach? So you have a much smaller pool.
How could it be someone like Yehuda, who is in the line of David, but before David?
I don't know if it could be before David. I don't know about that. But what the Gemara says, the Gemara says, if it's from someone who's alive in time of the Gemara, it gives the name of one of the Amoraim, one of the sages of the Gemara, who was known to be a descendant of David HaMelech, and say it would be like him. And the Gemara says, and if it's from someone who has already passed away, then Daniel. Because Daniel is a descendant of David HaMelech. Mm-hmm. Now, the Gemara is not saying it has to be Daniel, but the Gemara is saying there's a good candidate. Mm-hmm. So Daniel himself, who is foretelling when Mashiach is going to come in this very secretive way, and he himself is very troubled by it because he sees the expanse of history in front of him, and knowing there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering, and he does die. He's not like Eliyahu HaNavi, who's still alive. He does die eventually, but he himself might be Mashiach. It is possible that he will come back to life and be Mashiach. That is a possibility. The Gemara says his name as a candidate. So that's also a very interesting perspective, that Daniel is telling us when it's going to happen without really telling us, but at least piquing our interest, that now we should be constantly looking into Sefer Daniel to figure out these times. So Sefer Daniel remains very, very relevant because everybody's constantly looking at these psukim. This page becomes very dog-eared because everybody's looking back at this one passage or the other one also, and he himself might end up being Mashiach. That's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
The question I had was, why was it that with Yaakov, he was about to tell us that Mashiach, you know, when Mashiach would come, but here with Daniel, we're given right. this date and that thing.
Because Yaakov was going to say it without any ambiguity. Yaakov was going to say the real time.
Right.
This is ambiguous. This is not something which anybody could figure out with 100% certainty. Yaakov was going to say it with 100% certainty, and that Hashem did not want.
When was he once
said it? Right before he died, when he blessed the children. So it says that he was about to reveal it, and then he was unable to. Hashem took away the knowledge from him.
So Hashem wants to keep.
He wants it to be unknown. Yeah. Okay. I do want to mention to you. I don't think we're going to go into this next time. But I do want to mention to you. I mentioned it last time that here you have these nations that are compared to a ram or a goat, where last time the same nations in the previous parak were compared to first a bear and then a leopard and then a beast. So it is noteworthy that the nations of the world, the ones who exile us, are compared sometimes to a chaya, to a wild beast, and sometimes to a behema, I don't want to use the word domesticated, but just an animal, not a wild beast. Or, you could say it differently, sometimes they're compared to a kosher animal, and sometimes to a non-kosher animal. So the Persians, before, were compared to a bear, which of course is not kosher. Here they compare it to a ram, which is kosher. The Greeks were first compared to a leopard and now to a goat. Edom himself, Esav, is compared sometimes to a goat, as his name is Seir. Seir, which refers to hair, also is a word for a goat. Seirizim.
Same type of goat? Male goat? Female goat?
We don't know. I don't know if it has to be one or the other, but probably male, but I don't know. And he's also compared to a chazir, to a pig, which is obviously a non-kosher animal. So the very same nations that are enslaving us have sometimes a comparison to a non-kosher animal, sometimes to a kosher animal. It's interesting to be aware of that, and perhaps we'll pursue that further. I think next time we will go into Parak Test Chapter 9, but it is worthwhile to keep that in mind, and maybe at a later time we'll come back to it.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.